Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Going Off Track.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
Yes, it is Brad and Jonah.
The Brad and Jonah Show.
I feel like we find ourselves here doing these intros.
It's pleasant.
So often. It's nice, yes.
I should have offered, do you want a beer? I mean, I don't know, you just came from the dentist, maybe you don't want a beer.
Yeah, not really.
Okay. Next time you're here, though, I found out that when I was home for Thanksgiving that my hometown is home to like... my tiny little shitty hometown in the middle of Central Mass is home to like the best beer in the world.
What is it called?
It's called Treehouse.
Interesting.
It's this, and the only way you can get it is to go to the brewery and stand in line and buy it.
Really?
Yeah. My stepbrother gave it to me during Thanksgiving. It was delicious. And so...
And you still have some left?
I went and bought... Yeah, I bought like over a case.
Oh, nice.
I couldn't believe I went and stood in line. It wasn't a very long line, but... It's really good.
Man, now I kind of want one. I thought you were just going to offer me like a PBR
no,
or something.
I was
like,
I'll save some for you if you don't, because I realize you're, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate
that. You don't
want
to mix that stuff.
No. I mean, yeah, I mean, they didn't give me anything other than just a shot into my gums. But
it might affect the flavor. I don't want to waste it on.
Yeah, I also ate one of those like Zicam zinc things.
Forget it. I'll save you a beer.
You know, it's funny. I ate because I thought I was getting cold, so I bought all these zinc things, and you know they make everything taste terrible.
Yes.
So I had one, and then I bought these like a case of these protein bars, and I had one. I was like, these things are disgusting. I can't believe I have a whole case of them. And then I had one yesterday, and I was like, these are delicious. But I just, you know,
dude. So I actually, speaking of beer and zinc.
Oh, God.
One time I went into Niagara, and after I'd taken one of those zinc tablets, I forgot about it.
Have I heard this story? And you kept sending back like 9 beers? I feel like you've told this story before.
Because the zinc, you know when you have a really dirty tap?
Yes.
It tastes like, that's what it tastes like.
Yeah, it's weird. And it stays with you for a while.
Yeah, it's...
I should get the spray or something.
Well...
I feel like no matter what you do, though, that...
The shit that really makes it taste bad, those big tablets, those are the best ones.
That's what I've been...
You can get Zicam or whatever, and it doesn't affect the flavor of things as much, but I don't think it works as well either.
Yeah, mine definitely. Yeah, it's gross. But so I read this article, I don't know if you saw this, where they suggested to the MTA shutting down 24-hour subway service in general.
What?
Between like 12:30 and 5 a.m. because like only 1.5% of subway riders use the train during those hours. And I felt like last week we were talking about the net neutrality
Holy
thing. And to
shit.
Me, like, this is another issue where it's like...
They're going to make us into Boston?
Well, yeah, dude, totally. I mean, it's like, but it's also like, what about people that work in industries like late? Like, it's like, just because not a lot of people use it doesn't mean like those people should just be totally
this
negated.
Is fucking New York City, man.
I know.
This is what makes New York, is you can ride the fucking subway at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Brad, I know, man. But even, I mean, the subway now, even like the L train, like, you know, like it's shut, not running past Lorimer Monday through Wednesday for a couple weeks. And I had to take a shuttle, but like, I feel like the MTA is like really, really broke. And they're just like looking for ways to save money.
Infrastructure is falling apart.
It is falling apart.
We're going to return to the 70s. Maybe it'll be cool here again.
Maybe. Maybe it'll get cheaper here.
No, never happened.
Yeah, I just feel like things are going to get... The infrastructure is going to get worse, and it's just going to stay expensive.
Yeah.
Not a good combination, Brad.
Not a good one.
No.
Sorry to hear about that.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't happen.
I kind of think it's one of those... I don't think it'll... I mean, de Blasio says it won't happen. I think someone just kind of suggested it.
Right.
But, I mean, I would put nothing past.
I mean, it literally is kind of what makes New York, New York.
Yeah.
Is a 24-hour subway.
Yes.
So if that's gone, I might have to go too, man.
Yeah.
Just telling you, just warning, putting that out there.
New York City. Have you heard this? Brad is not messing around. You could lose one of your best residents.
Yeah. If you shut down the 24-hour subway, that's it.
I might be with you, Brad.
All right.
I might be with you.
Fuck you.
So anyways, all right. Today in the podcast, we have someone I met last year, Franz Nicolai. He's was in World Inferno Friendship Society. You may also know him as playing keys and other instruments in the Hold Steady. And he is also an incredible writer. He wrote a book, a memoir about touring.
The Humorless Ladies of Border Control.
Yes, that is what it's called.
Which is just, it's worth reading just for the title itself.
Yes, and it's about his international kind of travels and...
it's tour stories.
Tour stories. But yeah, told in a very interesting way. There's kind of a preview up on Noisy, I remember, that we kind of talk about. But yeah, we talk about some of those stories in the podcast, but if they interest you, you should just go out and buy the book. I know it's available on Amazon, and Franz is a very, very intelligent guy with a lot of really interesting stories. So yeah, I think it's definitely worth checking out. So yeah, Franz lives upstate, but he came down to this podcast, so
at
thank
Pulse
you to him
Music.
At Pulse Music. Thank you, Brad. Yeah, so thank you to Pulse Music. If you're wondering why the podcast sounds so good, it's because of Pulse Music,
and because it's recorded in a professional facility.
It is, with Steve Grabowski. So thank you to Steve for staying late, letting us do this podcast. Thank you, Franz, for coming in. I know the Hold Steady just played like four shows in New York, sort of celebrating the holidays. So yeah, all those old Hold Steady records are great. World Inferno Friendship Society, also an amazing band. And yeah, Franz is always guesting on people's stuff. So yeah, if you just kind of Google him, you can check it out, see what he's up to. But yeah, let's get into it right now. This is one we've wanted to do for a while. So let's do it with Franz from the Hold Steady on Going Off Track.
It's going off track!
Do you think if I really wanted to get into Princeton right now, like, what? How long would it take me to get into Princeton if I was, like, fully committed to the process?
Depends how what long? You wanted to go for.
Yeah. No, just to get in.
How did you test when you were, like, in high school?
The SATs are okay. My class rank and things of that nature were poor.
I think your best bet is going to be honorary degree.
But what do I have to do to get that?
To get an honorary degree? I don't know.
From Princeton, you have to do
yeah.
I don't think they do that at Princeton.
What my sister's...
I might get one from, like, I don't know, Montclair State or something. But I'm not... Princeton doesn't
Morris
give
County.
It.
Yeah.
They don't even have enough, like, real ones to give
My sister went to an Ivy League school and her speaker was Bono. And they gave him one. Mm. So you just need to get to Bono level.
Bono gets everything.
That's like
mine was Quincy Jones.
Really?
Really? Yeah.
That's a pretty good one.
A good one.
He does they have gave more him than one.
Mine had a similar name. Mine was James Earl Jones.
No.
Yeah. And at the end, he said, let the force be with you.
Wait, what schools did you guys go to?
NYU.
NYU.
Ithaca College.
James Earl Jones did Ithaca?
Yeah. And you
Is
know,
he just from there?
No, we got him. The year before, we got a little duo known as Ben and Jerry.
They get paid for this?
They definitely get paid for
You
that.
Get paid for college?
I think
college?
You get paid a lot.
Like
so is this
50,
a thing, like,
grand.
During graduation season, there's, like, a speaker circuit?
Oh.
Like, the whole thing?
It seems like there's it. Yeah.
There's speakers all year.
And what Ivy League is, like, the job to get, like, Bono or, like,
I think so.
Jimmy Carter.
These schools have a lot of money in the budget, so I think it's,
right.
Yeah.
So, Jonah, so we gotta finger off this honorary degree from Princeton. So that's not realistic. So say I put my kids in daycare, no job. We're not talking money is of no consequence right now.
Okay.
I'm just fully dedicated to this. Like, what do I gotta do to get into Princeton?
I think it really depends on what program you would want to go, right? Like, if you wanted to go for creative writing. Study with Eugenides.
Right.
Just like write a bunch of short stories.
Yeah.
Oh, like so go more in my body of work.
I
was thinking more like grinding it out at community college with like a 4.0
You
gotta
go. You gotta go. Like we've never seen anything like this before. This guy was a drummer in a band, but he writes these amazing stories, and it's like just weird.
I feel like you know, being coming at it, you know, slightly later in life and from a very interesting, you know, life background. I think that counts. You know. You're like,
towards my honorary degree, towards or just like my diversity, into the program?
Towards your diversity cred.
Yeah. I think you start in some sort of like adult school situation, like a part time. Eke your way in there. That's what I think.
Yeah, I was thinking more in like a Rudy Rudiger sort of way that I'm gonna like, you know, grind it out at the small schools and really prove my worth. I'll do landscaping. With Rock, the guy who played Rock. I thought that was the
And
way
you know,
to go.
You also, nope. It also requires what they, what I think the technical term is a shit ton of money.
Oh, I thought you were going to say intelligence.
No, anybody can go to college.
Yeah, a lot of money to go to Princeton. Yeah. What, 60, 80 grand? Something?
I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, but the percentage of people who are paying sticker price on a situation like that is pretty small.
That's a lot of scratch.
Yes.
So, Franz, thanks for coming by. Yeah. Thanks for your input on this.
I figured this was one of those situations where it starts rolling.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No. This is important stuff.
It is important stuff.
What are we going to talk about? Music?
Yeah.
It's up to you.
Yeah. So, what's going on?
I'll talk about whatever.
You, I'm
doped up on cold medicine.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh,
nice.
No.
I like it.
Do you like cold medicine?
Yeah, I do like cold medicine.
We talked about this last week. Yeah. Pretty sure we got into this last podcast.
We talked a lot
Jonah
about
robo-tripping.
Yeah. So you're living upstate. Were you here before? When did you move from here?
In the long term, yeah. I mean, I was here for 17 years. And then my wife's an academic, so after she finished her PhD, we bounced around for a couple of years following her career. We were in Toronto for a year and Boston for a semester and then back here. And then she got a job up at Bard, so we moved up there 4 years ago.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm just recently been kind of introduced to the academic world, and I've noticed like that's kind of how it's like wherever you get the job, that's kind of where you have to.
Well, they make a lot of PhDs and they don't make a lot of professorships, so you take what you can get. Yeah. And a lot of them are in, you know, Indiana or, you know, North Dakota.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. We've been lucky.
That's
so
really lucky.
Yeah.
Did you like Boston?
I wasn't crazy about Boston. Yeah. I love Toronto.
Yeah.
I would have, if it was an option to stay there, I would have stayed there in a heartbeat. Absolutely.
Yeah. I love Toronto. Toronto's, I've always thought of Toronto as my second choice to New York. If I had to leave New York.
Isn't it where they film movie sequences for
Vancouver.
Cheaper?
It's Vancouver.
Oh, it's Vancouver.
Yeah. No, Toronto is like they got great food. It's really a cliche to say how nice Canadians are. Yeah. But I'll put it this way. I went up there like within the first week I had to go to the city hall to get a parking permit and some other stuff. And I got there at like, I would say 4:45. And if you can imagine getting to city hall in down, like borough hall at 4:45 and trying to get somebody to give you some permits and stuff, like forget about it.
Yeah.
And it was like walking into a Montessori school. Like nice carpeting, like soft light. I got up to the woman's counter and she was like, oh, welcome to Canada.
She knew
how
you
long
by
are you going to be here? I was like, don't you, you got to go soon. Let's get this processed, you know? Yeah.
Well-funded Canada. Government, huh?
Love it.
Is that what could happen?
Dude,
is that
I don't
happens
know.
When you decide to I go think, into social services?
Well, it's $15 for a six pack. That's how it gets funded.
Even a Labatt's?
Yeah, the beer is really expensive. Yeah. Booze is expensive. But I got I got glasses. I got you could get a massage every couple months on the government.
Whoa! Listen, you can always make gin in a bathtub. All this other stuff is hard to get.
All this business that people, you know, you hear people saying, oh, the Canadians coming down here for our healthcare. It's like, no fucking way,
no.
Man.
Yeah.
It's heaven on earth up there.
That's crazy talk.
Were you playing music up there?
Not much.
Yeah.
Not much. that was, I had had a fresh baby. And so okay. I was sort of like staying home with the kid and reassessing my life.
Yeah, yeah.
Undergoing an existential crisis.
I understand.
Is that how you get into a lot of the writing stuff? I saw you're doing reviewing and things. Is that something you can do remote? And that's
well, that's when I wrote my book, basically, mm-hmm. was during that period. That's okay. when I finished my book.
And you did some really long essays sort of for Noisy around that time, or is that...
They ran the last section of my book
okay.
as in three parts.
Got it.
Basically, the when I was in Ukraine after the Maidan Revolution. Yeah.
Okay.
I was there in 2014. So I guess Toronto in 2015 is when I was writing the book.
So were you like, what was your kind of routine like? Did you have like a set time each day where you would sit down and work on it or?
Well, I had a
baby yeah.
under a year old, so routines, you yeah, know. Yeah. I, you know, to be honestly, what I did is I quit drinking for a while and wrote at night.
Yeah,
I found that to be really effective.
Was it something that would like help, like relax you at night instead of drinking?
Like, no, it was just that was the time that was available.
Oh, okay.
And so if I hadn't had a couple drinks with dinner, I could concentrate with my on my book. What I was doing during the day, I mean, I was working as a piano tuner. Just sort of like hung up my Craigslist. Well, they don't have Craigslist up there, but the Toronto version of Craigslist, and biking around tuning the horrible beat up Spinets of Toronto.
How did you learn how to do that?
It was just one of those things I picked up because I was a musician and I needed a portable skill that I could do to, you know, patch over the months off here and there.
Wow. Like
piano tuning and bartending. And piano tuning is the hours are more forgiving than yeah. bartending.
So can I ask you, so piano tuning seems to be like not that easy, right? It seems that when you hire a piano tuner, it's kind of
like... I think
like,
it's magic.
It is, right?
Yeah,
it's like
totally,
calling a surgeon.
Yeah.
It is. If you hire a real piano... I was a hack piano tuner. Let me be clear.
Get an iPhone app.
There are people who train for 3 and 4 years to be
yeah,
piano technicians and can rebuild pianos and do all sorts of things like that. I can tune your piano, you know?
So, but it's not like tuning a guitar,
because it's like the
right?
compensated... You have to compensate for.
That's right. There's a, you know, the edges curve sharp, and it's yeah, yes.
So it's not
a short answer.
Let's not
go deep into the weeds of
because there's a piano in there. We could check it out. You could give us a demo.
Well, I did imagine from like my like ogre drummer brain. I imagine I'm like, oh well, there are strings, and then they each have a note. And that's how you would tune a piano.
It's probably closer to tuning drums than a guitar.
Okay. It is, because,
well,
first of all, so you got 88 keys. That doesn't mean there's 88 strings. There's a lot more than that, because
right,
there's
right.
the low ones are one string. The whole middle register is three strings, one string, two strings, up to three strings for most of it. And so you sort of... You tune the quick and dirty way to do it is to turn in each trio you tune the middle string to the tuner, and then you tune the outer strings to the middle string by ear.
Okay.
Basically eliminate the beats and then you go through up and down it and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway,
so I guess it's another thing I got to scratch off.
Yeah.
Unless you go to Princeton, they can teach you how to tune pianos at Princeton.
Well,
it takes 4 years.
Why am I going to take that class, Brad? come on. Just think that through.
Franz, could you talk a little bit about, maybe people aren't familiar about the premise of the book and sort of how it came together?
Yeah, the book is called The Humorless Ladies of Border Control. And it's about... the subtitle is Touring the Punk Underground from Belgrade to Ulaanbaatar. And it covers a bunch of years where I was doing a bunch of touring in the post-communist world, from Eastern Europe, across Russia and Ukraine, Mongolia and China. We ended up leaving the China chapter off just so it would be slightly more conceptually unified as a post-communist Slavic world. But that's it. That's what the book is, you know. It's tour diaries plus, right? So it's the touring experience plus sort of journalistic talking to the people who were putting on DIY shows in these places, and people who were making music and what their lives were like and what it meant to them to be doing that kind of work in the places they were living. And then also sort of engaging with the literary history of those places. So you can't really write about, for example, traveling on the Trans-Siberian Railroad without acknowledging on some level that people have written about that before, you know, from Paul Thoreau to Chekhov. Right, so, and my interest and engagement with the Slavic world up until that point had been entirely basically through books, through getting into Russian literature as a high schooler, as many people do, and then getting into Balkan music in the great New York Balkan music explosion of 2000, 2001. And so a lot of the experience for me was going to these places and comparing my impressions of them that I had gotten through these books to the my experience of actually being there. And so for, you know, for each place I was going, I would have a book or two that was sort of my, I guess I would say, fellow traveler, if that wasn't too loaded a term in this context. yeah, Rebecca West for the Balkans and Eva Hoffman for Eastern Europe and Christine for Russia and so on.
And I had read your interest in accordion came from a German side of your family. Is that your background, or did you have a family background in Eastern Europe at all?
I have a complicated ethnic background.
Okay.
Habsburg mongrel is sort of my shorthand for it.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah. Well, the pre-World War I Eastern and Central Europe, the Habsburg Austro-Hungarian Empire, so my father's side, were ethnic German, at least one branch of it were ethnic Germans who lived in what is now Romania, but was then Hungary.
Gotcha.
And then on my mother's side, I believe ethnic Italians who lived on the Greek island of Crete.
Wow.
And then there's some Basque in there, but yeah, there was at least one branch of the family came from Northern Romania, Southern Hungary area, and then made their way through Germany to the United States.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny when you go back far enough in European history and you start to see, that's why I don't even understand nationalism at some point, because of the movement, the constant like movement and blurring of lines, like through the last, you know, few hundred years, where, you know, I didn't realize until recently that I could be Czech pretty easily. I thought I was Polish this whole time. And then I saw an old map that had the region my family's from in Czech Republic. It's just...
You have the added complication of being Ashkenazi Jew.
Well, right.
So
who knows what we were running from at the time.
I mean, the very concept of nationalism, or like a state based on national identity, is relatively recent. Like, post 1848 and politically speaking, post World War I.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Even that would go for like a Russian or a Chinese or something like that. They would.
Well, these were giant imperial operations, right? Multi-ethnic imperial political situations.
Right.
You know, the Habsburg Empire, combined everything from Germans, you know, to everything that we could think of as Eastern European states now, or like the Russian Empire contained, you know, all the Central Asian states and the Crimean Tatars and, you know, the Ukrainians and the Poles and so on.
So do you think like nationalism as it stands now is more, you know, political and cultural than it is ethnic at some point?
Well, that's complicated. the kind of nationalism we're talking about is based on this fantasy that you can draw a line include within it only the people that subscribe to a certain identity and exclude the people that don't subscribe, that you don't think feel like subscribe to that identity. And that's just a functional impossibility.
Right.
You know, that's what we see in the Middle East, is these arbitrary lines that, you know, some people got assigned to a country and some people didn't, and the Kurds didn't get a country assigned to them, and, you know, these things persist.
Right. It's something that has been just like fresh on my mind, trying to identify like what white nationalism is, and the idea that you could see somebody like less than 100 years ago from Russia, Italy, and Ireland all marching in the same group under the same nationalistic title. It's just confusing to me. Well, and I can't even understand it right now, and what its definition is, you know?
Nationalism based on an identity, on a self-assumed identity, is a reaction to feeling powerless, right? So the national movements of the late 19th century were about having some sort of self-determination in the context of these imperial frameworks. So, you know, white identity politics is something that comes up whenever people who worry about that sort of thing feel their political place being threatened.
Right. Makes sense.
Their place in the political hierarchy.
Speaking of that type of thing, I stumbled upon a really interesting story of when you were in Mongolia and you stumbled across like this manly Olympics with like only manly sports. And just can you tell a little bit about that story? Because it seemed really interesting.
Yeah, so I was traveling with my wife at that point, and we happened to be in Mongolia during the part of the year where they hold the Nomad Olympics, which celebrates the what they consider the three manly arts, which is archery, horse racing, and wrestling.
Of course.
There was a fourth one
that
was sheep ankle bone shooting, which was like sort of it was like, if you can imagine, a combination of dominoes with darts, maybe.
Okay.
You're sort of flicking these little bones at a distance and trying to hit a target. That was sort of the old man sport that took place in a tent, but it was part of the same Olympics.
Okay.
Yeah, we went to the opening ceremonies, which was in the soccer stadium in Ulaanbaatar, and there were a couple kids. There was a kid in there's one kid who was like in boots and braces, skinhead kind of get up, and another one who was in a Nazi uniform, parading around the stadium, and we're just like, what the hell is this? You know, looked it up, and it turns out there is a small but muscular neo-Nazi movement among young Mongolians, which is a little complicated, you know, when you try to parse it, because, you know, by no one's definition of Aryan purity would Mongolians qualify for. But their aim is basically against Chinese encroachment on Mongolia. There's a lot of like humiliating Mongolian girls who they think are sleeping with Chinese men and that sort of thing.
Oh.
Like racial purity of Mongolians.
Oh, okay. So they just spun the movement and just Mongolian purity rather than Aryan purity.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
So did you win all the events?
Yeah. How did you fare?
You know, it's not something I like to put in my CV. I don't want to brag or anything, but I'm a multi-gold medalist in Mongolian wrestling.
I had a question, too. I read that Paul Theroux book about the Trans-Siberian, you know, and I've seen a lot of films about it. I mean, it's one of those things I've always wanted to do, but I don't really know anyone that's done it. I mean, what was that experience? Would you recommend that experience? I mean, how much like prep did you have to put into it?
Well, it's just a train.
Yeah.
You know? It's just a train you can get on and you can ride and get off. And
it like, seems like so daunting for some reason. Like,
it's no more daunting than buying a cross-country Amtrak ticket.
Really?
Yeah. It helps if you know Russian.
Yeah.
But you don't have to.
Cross-country Amtrak can be daunting in its own right. There's a bunch of things that could come up in that trip.
Yeah. I mean, I recommend the experience of taking sleeper cars on a railroad sleeper cars, which are really not much of a thing in the United States, but it's a wonderful way to travel in the post-Soviet sphere. They have a great rail line that they built, you know, in the 30s and 40s, and still works, and it's kind of a comfy way to go. It has a little bit of the rhythm of... So I did this for a month in Russia. This is how I got around on tour. And it has a little bit of the rhythm of a tour bus, because you sleep in these bunks, You wake up in the town, get off, the promoter picks you up, you have all day to sort of bum around, play the show, they deliver you back to the train after the show, and you, you know, go back to sleep on your bunk and wake up in the next town.
Is there like water, sir? Like, can you shower on there and stuff like that?
No.
No.
No. There, I mean, there's three classes.
Okay.
There's the, we usually took second class, which is you're in a compartment with four bunks, two lower and two upper bunks. Mm-hmm. There's Platzkart, which is an open cart with just, you know, 20, 25 bunks full of strangers.
Right.
That's a little more rowdier, a lot more drunks.
Sure.
You know, but cheaper.
Yeah.
And then first class, you can get a compartment to yourself if you feel like splurging. But yeah, usually second class is fine. You get a bunk and you get, it's just sort of a flat vinyl bunk that folds down.
Right.
You get some bedding and a pillow and you sleep, and the train lulls you to sleep. It's quite nice.
Does it stop often? Like, how many?
It depends where you are.
Yeah.
And you know, the farther east you go in Siberia, the distances are so far. In many cases, there were several cases where it was like, play the show, spend the night on the train, spend all next day on the train,
Whoa.
Spend another night on the train before you got to the next city.
Crazy.
And that's just sort of lovely, because you don't, you know, no internet distraction, just stare out, watch the country go by, take some notes, read a book, drink a beer, take a nap. I mean, it's a really relaxing way to go.
Yeah, that sounds like vacation.
I mean, in the same way that tour is a vacation.
Well, right.
In which sense of not really.
Jonah and I like to frequent the Russian-Turkish baths here.
Yes.
Did you get to use any of those in your travels out there?
Not so much on tour, but when my wife's family and her research is in Ukraine, so I'm there a lot. And,
okay.
And definitely whenever we're there, we're doing a lot of banya there.
Yeah, I wonder... I met a guy the last time I was there. So I hadn't realized there's very special times at the Russian-Turkish baths, for some co-ed time, some female-only, some male-only. And this one time, sitting there talking, and a guy very forward and sweet to me, and I thought he was hitting on me, and it turns out he's just very forward, and he's Michael Keaton's stunt double.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I happened to just be sweating.
Wait, like Batman?
No, like Birdman.
Wow.
Like recent, and then told me a great story about his tattoo and like the trippy things that led to his tattoo and things of that nature. And it
did he bear a physical resemblance to Michael Keaton?
No. No,
he must have had a similar build.
Maybe in posture, but I've never sat shirtless next to Michael Keaton either. Regretfully, I've never done this. I don't know. But my neighbor, I live next to what used to be like Russian tenement housing, and now it's just mostly Russian people who rent apartments. And he said that there's no generals in the banya.
Yeah.
We're like we're all just cool in there. No three tiers, none of that. Like, you could be rubbing elbows with Michael Keaton's stunt double and you wouldn't even know.
Yeah, we've been there and there have been like pro athletes. Like,
yeah,
you figured
hockey
out,
player one
hockey
time.
Hockey player one time. Yeah.
But I never know what's like
Gretzky.
A lot of Russians and Scandinavians in the hockey world.
I never know what's good form in speaking to people in there.
I think it depends on the room. You got to read the room.
Am I just supposed to imagine everyone clothed?
No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, I'm like kind of a regular there now, so I feel like the people I like will kind of just insert myself in conversation. I feel like everyone there generally is pretty friendly.
Yeah, there are a lot of, but if you get too friendly, all of a sudden some like older woman will start like putting something on your feet, or like something weird will start happening like that. You'll get an oatmeal bath before you know it.
I don't know.
Is that what you call it?
I don't know, Benny. You've had a different experience than me.
Brad, you gotta come with us, pal.
I know. I don't know why.
You will someday. So, Franz, we have a segment on this podcast called Mystery Friend.
Mystery Friend.
Okay.
Basically...
Mystery Friend!
We reached out to a friend of yours, and we asked them to tell a story or... ask a question, and then you can do it, and then guess which friend of yours it was. It could be a bandmate, could be an ex-bandmate, could be a friend. And the question,
you already told me you were talking to Andrew recently.
I did talk to Andrew recently, but that doesn't mean that that's who it is. Okay. But it could be.
Could be.
It could be. Man, I feel... Okay, I'm going to do this anyways.
Mystery!
One time in England, the drummer for the Hold Steady and a bass player from another band tried to break a picnic table only using their jumping skills and their back. Hint, it was a festival. Second hint, they were both wasted. Who do you think that was?
That was Andrew.
That was Andrew. Yeah, yeah. I kind of blew this
you
already.
Gave it away.
I blew it earlier. Yeah.
But I would have guessed it.
But still, mystery
friend. I should have talked to Craig and had like a decoy question.
Mystery friend.
Yeah.
Mystery friend. It's an anticlimactic one.
Yeah, that was a pretty bad one.
Reading or Leeds.
Yeah. And so they jumped into a picnic table.
Did they successfully...
They were like, what's the wrestling move where you fall with your elbow
and
your hip?
Do any of you guys know this?
No idea.
Yeah, that's...
What is that? Don't look at me. I gave up on wrestling. Like
I feel like as people listening to, who are into wrestling listening
they're
to this
probably
are like losing their minds.
Yeah. Anyway,
someone
that's what they were doing.
Just
gotcha.
Went,
just dropping themselves
nerds.
On this picnic table.
Steven Smith. Oh, yeah, this is where we meet Steven. What is that? Power drop?
No.
The cranium cracker? I don't know, man.
I don't know.
I'm not a wrestler.
No.
You're not a wrestler.
I'm definitely not.
No, we're all hats here.
The other witness to that would have been this guy, C6 Steve, if you guys remember that,
that
fellow.
Uh-huh.
No.
He was hanging around that backstage area with his wife.
That's cool. I wanted to ask, like, you know, I was around when the World Inferno thing was starting, you know, around New Brunswick, and I don't think people realize, like, the completely, like, unique, subversive nature of what happened with World Inferno, where, like, that didn't, to me, like, that didn't come out of, I mean, I guess Sticks and Stones kind of had, like, a thing that was different, but to me, this didn't come out of, like, a scene. It kind of, like, created a scene, and all of a sudden, like, where most of me and my friends are, you know, singing along to, like, hardcore bands and going crazy, we find ourselves, like, dressed up in, like, tuxes,
yeah,
like, on the same night, like, drinking 40s and, like... You know, it just had this whole, like, specific vibe. And, you know, when I look back on it, it seems so, like, unique and special to me. And I kind of was curious if you could fill me in on, like, just how that came to pass. Like,
I don't know that I'm going to have necessarily more special insight. I mean, I think I agree. It's a really special band. And definitely the scene that grew up around it. Yeah, it was an if you build it they will come kind of situation.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like you're a ska band, you insert yourself into a ska scene and there's a built-in crowd or hardcore like that. It definitely built from the ground up. I mean, I was part of the band, I think, for the most dramatic part of that.
Yeah.
You know, where it went from like playing for 20 people at Brownies to selling out Bowery Ballroom.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was really I mean, that had a lot to do with early internet culture. Not early internet culture, but like early fandom internet culture.
Right.
Like message boards and MySpace and that whole thing. There were a couple people who were really active making World Inferno happen in that world.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know what to say about it exactly. It was a really special band and a really special time.
Well, I guess the coolest things like that are just sometimes really visceral and not totally thought out.
Yeah, it's a band that's gone through a couple stages. There was an early stage that was, you know, the post-Dixon Stone stage with Jack and Scott and their crew of basically whoever could show up and had a... you know, brass instrument that they once played in high school band.
Right.
And then there was the period... that had a really long, consistent lineup where the musicality was really high.
And what was that, like
that
2000?
2000 to 07, approximately. Like myself and Peter Hess and Eula, Lucky,
mm-hmm.
Ben Koch, Maura, Dan Bailey, Semra on percussion. And that was a real crew, you know? And then there was a transitional period, and I think... It seemed like it might not survive, and now it's sort of resurrected with another lineup now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's everybody's got who's been in music for a while has their one band. I feel like that's like the special family period where they really got on their feet and discovered how to do it and had their adventures. And definitely that's the band for me.
Just an odd mix of timing and people and places and.
I mean, one of the things about that period of the band was that, and I think this is rare, especially for a band that's that big. It was a 9-piece band. I would say 6 or 7 of those 9 people were songwriters, you know, or could have fronted their own band.
Sure.
So it was this real explosive mix of like people's creativity coming together and performance coming together. Like everyone on stage was encouraged to act like they were the front person.
Right. Was there someone where that would like, was there someone that was the impetus for sort of that? Like,
well, it's Jack's vision.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean the whole thing, he really, you know, I think a lot about this cause it wasn't clear to me at the time, but he was the guy, he was like an older brother figure for me. I think just really, as someone who came, you know, I grew up in really small, like rural New Hampshire and came down here wanting to like be a musician, but I didn't have a clear idea of what I was going to do. It's just like, let's join a bunch of bands and see what sticks, or like hadn't come up through a scene that taught you how to be cool, you know, and how to carry yourself.
Right.
And so joining that band and like he presents you essentially with a ready-made kit
right.
Of like here's how to dress, here's how to act, here's what's cool, here's what's not cool.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, I had to grow out of some of that stuff, but it was certainly a good starting point.
That's interesting.
Did you guys tour Europe a lot?
Yeah.
Did you guys do any tours with Ingo?
Yeah.
Yeah,
he was our guy.
Yeah, he was my guy for my band that era too.
Yeah.
He's
still doing it.
Yeah.
Rented gear from Ingo and even slept at his house.
Yeah. Right. Hamburg. Yeah. He drove us around. He's like the punkest guy I think I've ever met. Like so legit.
Yeah.
Like,
well, you guys to a fault.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
There is definitely like, I don't think if I rented like an Ingo kit, I knew for a fact, like at least like 2 of my stands were going to have like some mate. Like I had to bring tape from home. Like I just knew. I knew I was gonna have to tape the shit out of something.
Yeah, that's funk, man.
But it was cheap too. So like it's not easy to get around Europe, and if you can get around at that price,
right,
take it. One cymbal down, fuck it.
You guys probably experienced this. For your listeners, this is a guy who, when he wasn't on tour driving bands around in a Sprinter, slept in a sleeping bag at his own house so he wouldn't get used to comfort.
Yes.
I remember we were in a van and he was driving it, and where there a window was supposed to be was just plywood.
Yeah.
Like it was incredible. Yeah.
Is he from, Ingo?
Hamburg, I believe.
Yeah, he's German.
Well, Gunnar was Hamburg. Gunnar's in Bremen, that's right. Yeah, no, I think Ingo is Hamburg. I mean, this is a guy who had, like, basically every punk band for a generation toured with him.
Yeah. Like, Against Me, like, it was pretty wild. The early 2000s, yeah.
Guys like that are so punk rock. And it's like, you know, the thing that always bothers me is that, like, if they were going to write some, like, book about punk in, like, that time, like, some, like, 19-year-old kid with Liberty Spikes is going to be on, like, the cover of it, and that's going to be, like, the face of it, and that's going to be, like, the one who got, like, the girls and the money. Maybe not money, but girls and stuff like that, or boys. And like, there's always, like, dudes like Ingo. For like the fucking grinders, like none of it would exist.
Yeah, never made any money. Yeah. In fact, like
definitely lost money.
Yeah,
would have probably turned down on multiple occasions the opportunity of ever increasing his station, the slightest little bit.
Sure.
Yes,
people will never know.
Maybe that could be a cool book,
like the Unsung Heroes book.
Sounds like a doc.
Yeah. That'd be a great one. I mean, how did you kind of link up with the Hold Steady, and that? How did that kind of come together?
Well, that also came through World Inferno. I mean, World Inferno had played with Lifter Puller at like the Fireside Bowl or something.
Okay.
And there was sort of a mutual appreciation. We had one of their, we had their entertainment and arts EP in the van. They had broken up. They all didn't think they were going to do music anymore. Craig moved to New York, and he was working for a company that was at the time called DCN, Digital Club Network. I think later sort of morphed into eMusic / The Orchard eventually. But they were sort of ahead of the technology. Their whole thing was they put up a little camera in rock clubs all around the country, and you were supposed to be able to stream shows. Mm. But this, you know, we're talking 01, 02. People's streaming capacity wasn't enough right. for anyone to stream live video. And there, you know, nobody had that kind of thing at home. So what they were going to do also was branch out into putting out live records. Mm. And so one of the, that's basically how I got to know Craig, is he approached me as the representative of World Inferno, as the A&R guy from DCN saying, we want to do a World Inferno live record.
Okay.
So we worked together on that. And then during the process of that, he was like, yeah, I'm putting this band together. It's not that serious, but we're making a record. Do you and Hess want to come and play on a couple tracks? And that was almost killed me, the first Hold Steady record. Hmm. And then I would sort of jump up and play with them when they'd played in New York that year after that record came out. And then when they were getting ready to record Separation Sunday, they were like, actually, do you want to join the band? And about half of that record was written already. So I came up with parts, and then we wrote the rest of the record and recorded that. And then it was sort of off to the races. Hmm. And then, yeah, 2005, most of 2006, I was trying to be in both bands with increasingly not as good results. I mean, because I was super committed to World Inferno. You know, that was my band. That was a way bigger band at the time than Hold Steady. And it was sort of like, those were my people. And it was sort of like more in line with my aesthetic musically. But eventually it just got to be too much. And Craig was like, listen, you got to make a decision. Hmm. So.
Yeah, one of the anniversary Hold Steady shows you did with Laura Stevenson.
Yeah.
We brought her up. It was so great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I was hoping you could fill me in a little, like, it's something I know so little about, but the program you do through Columbia, or still do, the Anti-Social Music?
Oh, that's not through Columbia. We did, that was like the very first concert we did, we did on the Columbia campus in 2000, because a couple of the people had gone there.
Gotcha.
But no, the Anti-Social Music is a nonprofit composer-performer collective that I formed with some other people, gosh, 17 years ago now. It's still going. I'm less involved with it. And basically, when I started being on the road all the time, I just didn't have time to write chamber music, you know, because that involves sitting at a piano for hours at a time.
But. Right. So, I mean, is it like like alternative composition for that world? It seems like it's a little like...
Yeah, basically. So it was like people who, you know, I got a degree in composition. I knew some other people did too, but that world of academic composition, excuse me, you know, you write these pieces and then you mail them out into the void and try and get somebody to play them. And meanwhile, we were all playing in bands and doing that, just like making it happen.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem like there was anything stopping us from doing that with the chamber music as well, right? Because we knew performers, who weren't playing, and we knew composers who weren't getting played.
Right.
So we got together, you know, the core of it was usually around 10 or 12 people, and we would put on twice a year concerts of all new works, all new
and all
premieres.
Of your unique compositions?
Yeah, and and we solicited, you know, work from all over the sphere of people who are doing cool new stuff whose sort of attitude was simpatico with ours, which was not to, you know, not, you know, black turtlenecks and tuxes in a recital hall.
Right.
But, you know, we would do the chamber music shows in the, you know, at North Six or at Hamilton Street or,
sure,
you know, all the same places that the bands were playing. And it was, you know, that music's not for everybody. but it's not meant to be. Like, a lot of music's not for everybody. So,
but at least
I'm pretty proud of it. You know, we premiered 200-ish works of new, you know, for lack of a better word, classical music.
So cool. And it's still going.
It's still going, yeah. And then we started doing a commissioning project where we would approach people from outside that world who we thought had really interesting musical ideas but didn't necessarily have the technical capacity or the training to write for the kind of instruments that we could offer.
Oh, okay.
So we would say, listen, well, if you're interested, we'll partner with you and we'll use what we have to if you're interested in writing for this kind of a group. So we did something like that with His Name Is Alive. We did something like that with Dilek. We did a really amazing piece with them. And some other groups like that. So, yeah.
It's cool. It's kind of like a DIY, almost punk rock version of in that world.
That's exactly what it is. It's recreating the commissioning and collaboration model of, you know, from Lincoln Center down
sure.
to.
Is there a very, like, I mean, I again know very little about it, but I have to imagine there's a pretty snobby, elitist upper tier in this kind of world where it's a little tough to crack that world.
Yeah. Yeah. You imagine correctly.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things in the last 20 years is that model that I still feel like that we were one of the pioneers of, has become an institution in its own right.
Right.
Right. There's a generation of people who grew up like we did, trained as jazz players or classical musicians, but who don't see the genre different. Also, we're into, you know, black metal, and don't see that genre differentiation. There's labels like New Amsterdam and now venues like National Sawdust. You know, there's a lot of ensembles doing that sort of thing, the, you know, post-genre classical music, you know, for good or ill. I mean, I think those, obviously the ones that have succeeded are good at playing within that system. You know, right. In the same way that Bang on a Can, a generation before, is good at playing within that system. You know, these are like people who still went to Juilliard.
Right.
You know, and our stuff, antisocial music, I think was always a little rougher around the edges.
Yeah.
So
cool.
But I'm proud of the legacy of that group.
I know where to start if I'm going to crack into that world now. I'm going to start with you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you wear? Like upscale ones, they have like coattails or, you know, they look like penguins.
Well, what like, do you wear when you play a show?
Well, just like black stuff. Just like black. I mean, I guess pretty much what I'm wearing right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I might put on shorts.
I mean, I would wear a suit, but that's just because I wear a suit when I perform.
Yeah.
But people just wear whatever they wear.
Would you feel weird not wearing a suit when you play?
Yeah, I would.
Like, it feels like putting on something, like going to work, kind of?
It's more like, you know, going into the phone booth and putting on the Superman outfit,
yeah,
right? It's
yeah.
It's about getting into character psychologically.
Sure.
You know, because I'm not necessarily as performative in regular life as I am on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a way of demarcating the edge of the stage.
Yeah.
Being like, now I'm in character as Mr. Outgoing, Mr.
Cool.
Talkative, Mr. Entertainer. And then, you know, when I take it off, I can go back to being... But I've tried to play a couple shows in just jeans and a t-shirt, you know, rarely.
Yeah.
But I have done it. And it's much more... I don't know. It doesn't feel this. I don't feel like I can perform at the same level. Now, maybe that's, you know, that's just what I'm used to. You know, it's a way people deal with state performance anxiety in all kinds
sure.
of different ways. That's
yeah.
that's just a crutch.
I get diarrhea. Yeah. Just the shit a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
Have you, are you, that's, yeah. Sorry, I'm just trying to change the subject to literally anything. I feel like when we talked, maybe were you saying you were working on a second book possibly, or
yeah,
is that something you're still kicking around?
I got two book projects. One is, that's probably going to come first, is a novel that I'm I don't know, 50 pages from the end of a first draft of, and then there's a nonfiction thing that I talked to Benny for, mm-hmm. that that sort of is on hold based on I got about 90 hours of interviews that needed to be transcribed, and there's only so much bandwidth at any given time.
I'm actually one of them.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's, you know, that's still sort of inching along too.
Cool.
Do you transcribe stuff yourself or you send it out usually?
Well, I did the first couple and immediately I said, this is not something I want to be spending my time doing.
I did it for a couple hours today. It is one of my least favorite things to do.
It's awful.
Oh, they're pro transcribers?
They're 100% are.
Yeah, there are. Yeah.
My Absolutely. Wife hires them.
For journalists.
All the time. Yeah.
What does it cost to get that done?
It's expensive. It's like $1 a minute.
It's $1 a minute. That's a place I use too.
$1 a minute?
If I'm really busy, I'll send it. But they're like try to get someone that understands the field you're in, but yeah. Like for music they'll like get a lot of stuff wrong, like bands and people's names, and like then it'll just say unintelligible, and I'm like, yeah, like keep like I can you
because
know
it's a like, term like a music term.
Yeah, like yeah, I mean this is the one site I use, but yeah.
I did find a woman who's good and who does it cheap, but it's just like every time I have a spare $100, I'll get another one done, you know, that sort of thing. And there's a couple good programs now, but you still have to. And it's what's the one? I can't remember what it's called. I tried one out that sort of works, but you still have to go through
something
and edit it, and it takes almost as long.
Yeah, yeah.
And you still have to listen to yourself talk, which is the worst. So. So
yeah, I feel
that.
Like we should be there with all the virtual reality stuff we have, transcribing. Like that
Google
should be easy.
Google will soon have us there fully. It's just a question of because they're almost there with just the intelligibility.
Translate is insane.
Yeah, they need to get to the point where like what you were saying, where they would assign you somebody that knows the field. They need to get to the point where they can figure out what a human being would say.
Yeah. Right.
Which is what they're working on.
And then for Google to do it, you'll have to submit your soul to their matrix. You know?
Yeah, I think I've done that already.
You signed up for Gmail. You click accept.
Was that it?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's fine print.
I didn't realize I did it that many years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Shit.
What about musically? What are you working on right now?
I did some composition stuff this past year. There's a choreographer named Allison Chase that I've been working with the last couple of years. She was a member of Palabolas for a long. She was a founding member of Palabolas, if that means anything to your listeners. But I wrote a couple dance scores for her. One of which premiered last year, and one of which this summer. I wrote a choral song cycle. Do you know this artist Fly?
No.
She's from like East Village squatter 80s and 90s kind of world. She used to illustrate for New York Press. I think she had a thing in Maximum Rock and Roll for a while.
How's it spelled? Fly? F-L-Y?
Fly, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Her signature series is this portrait series she calls Peeps. It's basically head and shoulders portraits that she does of people in her world, people who sort of are coming through, you know, either whether they're artists and musicians that you heard of or just like whoever's staying at C-Squat that she finds interesting. And she'll interview them while she's drawing their portrait and sort of transcribe parts of their conversation in the negative space around the head and shoulders.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went through her archives. This was a bunch of years ago I started working on this. I went through her archive and picked out some of them and edited down the transcripts, her transcripts of their interviews, and used that as a text to set for choir. And finally finished that last summer and premiered it this summer and just put it up on Bandcamp yesterday.
Nice.
So that's the very freshest thing.
Wow. I mean, do you feel like when you're on tour and like there's an opening band or someone, like I feel like if I was you, I would be so snobby. Like, is it okay? Can you listen to music and not be like, from like a compositional standpoint, this is terrible, but I still like it?
It's a complicated question.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because it's not even from a compositional standpoint. Because there's really dumb music that I love a lot. Sure. You know, it's more like I know how all the tricks work. And so I have to trick myself when I'm trying to write music myself. I have to trick myself. That's one of the reasons for a bunch of years why I was picking up new instruments all the time, because I can't just sit down at a piano and play a G chord and a C chord and be like, "Hey, I just wrote a song G and C." But if I was just learning to play banjo and I just learned how to play G and C, I can rediscover how cool G and C sounds.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a way of like getting around my snobby elitist barrier.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's a problem once you do anything for long enough, right?
To
retain. To retain your amateur's enthusiasm for it once you're a professional.
And you can almost relate that just to life.
Yeah.
You like kids almost have just an amateur's enthusiasm. They don't
for everything.
And eventually like you just get to the point where you see too much for what it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also like, for example, as a piano player in rock bands, right? Like, I play on people's records. They mail them to me. I'll play play on them and send them back, or like come in more and more that instead of actually going into the studio, usually, or accordion. So usually there's three things that they want from me. It's either pounding piano, organ pads, or like some kind of Tom Waitsy Pogue-y accordion.
Right.
Like, I know that's totally typecast.
We know the guy.
We know the guy. Yeah. And so that's one of those like, do I really got to do this again? You know, I know that's what's going to make them happy.
Yeah.
If I send them something else, that's not what they want. So that's like, and for those sort of purposes, yeah, you know what? I'll do that. Sure.
Yeah.
But in the context of being in a band, sometimes that's also what they want. Mm. And if it's a project where I have personal buy-in, I'm resistant to just playing an organ pad. And it's like, what else can I do that's a little different that we haven't done before? Like, what, you know, how can we stop from plagiarizing ourselves or just doing like the easy thing?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always an easy sell.
Well, it's interesting because like when you mention it like that, it would lead me that you would be more comfortable in writing just for yourself.
Notice that I did that for a bunch of years.
Well, and then I saw in another interview that you said the process of releasing material is like frustrating and humiliating.
Yeah.
Like that was a direct quote from you.
Yeah. I stand by that.
Yeah. And like, what is it about, like, do you find when you would release something with World Inferno or Hold Steady where you were just like a piece of the puzzle, did you find it as exposing as you do when you're releasing your own stuff like that?
Well, if you release something under your name and somebody doesn't like it, they're criticizing you by name.
Right.
So there's that.
Yeah. No one's like, these,
you know,
Franz's,
if someone did,
organ parts were dog shit on this record. Like that.
I mean, there
happen.
Were there was a constituency that felt like keyboards ruined the Hold Steady.
What?
There was that constituency.
Germans?
Those people have been,
Germans,
have been
people that love guitars.
Have been lost to history. But yes, there are guitar chauvinists out there who believe that keyboards do not belong in true rock and roll.
There are guitar chauvinists out there, huh? Goodness gracious.
You know what I mean?
No,
people
I
who
do
are
know.
Like guitar is the guitar
oh,
is
no,
the
no,
number
no.
one instrument.
I'm right. with you times 100 on this.
Yeah.
I mean, if I have to stare at a snobby guitar player's butt again, another. I mean, it's basically my life.
Yeah,
staring at the asses of chauvinist.
Guitar.
You know, no, not chauvinist. I hope not.
Maybe now. That's how you get paid until you go to Princeton and learn.
Oh, is that how I do it?
Yeah.
Oh, this is my angle. The back angle.
So I hate citing Wikipedia for anything.
Why?
Just because I feel like it's like really hacky.
Huh.
Or it always. Whenever I say something Wikipedia, it just sounds like, I don't know.
It's a good starting point.
It's a good starting point.
I know how quickly your hand gets cut off if you actually put up false information on there.
You think?
Oh, I know. I have a friend who does this intentionally, and he's had two separate servers blocked from Wikipedia for fucking with it too much. I have only once had a Wikipedia page, and it was Sidney Poitier's copy and pasted under my name. And it didn't make it very long. It was only a couple hours.
How long? Couple hours.
Yeah, that's couple it. Hours. Couple hours. And no, and still, I don't have a Wikipedia page. That was the only time it happened. Very bad. But I can't make my own. I feel ashamed.
Yeah, I think they don't want you to do that.
I think probably most people with Wikipedia pages who are drummers probably make their own.
There's definitely.
I think some of them.
I know at least one drummer who assiduously edits his own Wikipedia.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
I just Google it all the time to see if like someone somewhere was just like, oh, this guy's done a bunch of stuff. I'll give him a link. You know, suck.
I think a lot of people. I feel like some it's bands and stuff. Some people like you're like this is so detailed. Like the detail
I feel
is
like this goes into your same thing of like writing your goodbye letter.
Yeah, how do you know where you went to middle school
for a month?
Yeah,
that's another trend that drives me insane. When some band's been together for like a year and their bass player leaves to go back to school, and it's like this 4-page letter. Like,
we've been asking this lately. What do you think is the minimum criteria? Like prerequisite you have to meet to be able to submit a goodbye letter? Like, how much of a commitment do you
have to call a press junket?
To do press about your exit, like a full album and a touring cycle.
I guess I feel like if people care, they'll come to you and ask.
I think you need to be a founding member. Fucking that's it.
Yeah,
end of story.
Exactly. End of story. Or maybe there's like a ratio. Like if a band has like 12 records and you were on 9, that's
like if Ron Wood left the Rolling Stones.
That's legit.
He could give a press. He could release a statement.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, you're right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's.
I know that's going.
It's like, also the Rolling Stones.
What do you think is the minimum? Bare minimum to release a press junket about your release.
I don't know, but in my experience, I would recommend if you're leaving a band, say nothing.
Yeah.
That's good advice.
Just
the Irish goodbye.
And this is sort of
publicly, I'm saying. You know, you gotta talk to your bands
in general.
You don't have to release a statement.
No.
It only causes trouble. How many bands
trust me
have released a statement, oh, we're breaking up, and it was foolish.
Oh, foolish.
Because if they just shut up for 3 years, they could have just come back and play.
Social media self importance. Everyone's branding themselves all the time. And how could if you have 12 people who are interested, you must feed your 12 with a statement. That's how it goes.
Yeah, I was friends with a band that broke up, and they were big enough to headline Music Hall of Williamsburg, but you know, not huge. And a couple years later, I was talking to one of them. It's like, so are you guys gonna do a reunion show or anything like that? And she was like, we were big enough that people were sad when we broke up, but not big enough that they would be excited for us to get back together.
Wise. Very
yeah,
wise.
I thought that was a stupid.
Wise words.
That's really a very particular level to be at.
That is true.
And to know that that's where you're at.
Sure.
It's good to know.
But on your page, on the Hold Steady page, it said that you joined the band, rejoined in 2016. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I saw you play that show with them, but I wasn't sure if it was just like the anniversary type thing.
I mean, at this point, we're just doing like every step of the way.
Yeah.
I know. With everybody in the band, it's like, hey, do we want to do this other thing? Yeah, let's do it. Why not? You know, because the band, you know, to be honest, was not that active for almost 2 years before that.
Sure.
It wasn't about me.
Right.
They were taking some time off.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it was I assume it went down was they got an offer from Riot Fest for the 10-year Boys and Girls thing, and it went around and people were into it, and then they asked me and I was into it.
Sure.
And it was just like, you know, baby steps, let's see how this goes, and it's been fine.
Great. That's cool.
I mean, really, it's that Brooklyn Bowl thing. We did a long weekend in Chicago earlier this year. We're doing the Brooklyn Bowl thing again next week.
Oh, nice.
And then a long weekend in London in March.
Okay.
So the stakes are low in terms of a time commitment.
Which is nice, I'd imagine, for someone, you know, like, with family and has all this other stuff going on.
Everybody's got stuff going on, yeah. Craig's got his records.
I know, I'm so bummed. You know, we were supposed to do a podcast with John Sampson when Craig was in town at Brad's house, and I had jury duty. I had to cancel it.
Bummer.
The judge didn't understand.
He was actually
a big Propagandhi fan and not a Weaker Thans fan. Yeah, I think that's why he put me on.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Still mad.
Still mad.
This is bullshit.
All right.
Hey.
Thank you, Franz, so much for coming by. If you dug those stories, pick up his book, The Humorous Ladies of Border Control. Like we talked about on this podcast, I think he's working on some other writing stuff. So, stay plugged into that. And obviously I don't need to promote The Hold Steady or World Inferno Friendship Society. If you've made it this far, you probably are a fan, or if you're not, you should be.
Yeah. Check out The Hold Steady. They're definitely
good band.
Yeah. They're one of those bands that I think appeal to people who's not necessarily Bruce Springsteen fans.
Yeah.
And a Bruce Springsteen fan.
Yeah. It's a tough balance. What's funny that you mentioned Bruce Springsteen is because I met Franz through Andrew, who used to play bass in Against Me, and his new band played at this place, Cape Town, in Brooklyn. And I was talking to Andrew, and he's mentioned in Springsteen's biography.
Really?
Yeah. There's like a part where he's like, because I think his son is like an Against Me fan or something. And he's like, yeah, I met these guys in this band and whatever. And Andrew is kind of this bearded guy, played bass. And so like, that's pretty crazy. I mean, like, I don't know if every member of the band, I don't know if Laura, if she was in there and everyone, but I know Andrew was mentioned specifically by name in Springsteen's memoir.
Nice.
Which is like, that's I feel something. Like at that point you sort of like, that's so cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yeah, so I have a Springsteen connection between Andrew and Franz. I feel like without Andrew, I never would have met Franz. Franz would have never done the podcast. The whole course of our lives would be different. We wouldn't be sitting in your apartment right now talking about
it. Wow.
Let that sink in for a second.
I'm not even sure I can, but I'll try.
If you want to hear these types of deep existential issues, you can become a patron.
Yeah.
Go to patreon.com.
I would say if you're still listening to this part of the podcast, you probably are a real fan.
Yes, you are.
And if you want to get a lot of this kind of rambling nonsense,
yes,
you can
yes.
get it.
You will get bonus episodes that may consist of me and Brad talking about jury duty. maybe we'll do an episode about taxes or gardening. Who knows what other juicy topics we will discuss. But no, we did a bonus episode last month. And
we got another one coming out soon.
We'll do another one coming out soon.
There's outtakes.
There's outtakes. We're going to try to get the other guys from the podcast involved. Maybe some special guests.
There's going to be some video posted soon.
Yes. Maybe some merchandise.
And there will be merch. I'm waiting on a new logo. But as soon as we get that, I think we're going to have some new merch.
Yes.
So there'll be some stuff sent out to the to
yeah,
the real fans.
We figured after 6 years, maybe we should try to, like, you know,
not go out of pocket.
Not go totally out of pocket. Yeah.
It's patreon.com/goingofftrack. You can also get there via our website, Going Off Track. You can also donate at venmo.com/offtrack. My name should come up. So just make sure it does, so you didn't misspell it.
Yeah. Don't donate to one of those fake Going Off Track accounts.
Yeah, screw those guys.
And yeah, thanks again to Pulse Music and Steve Rywalski for making us sound so good. And
thank you, fans,
and thank
for still
you, fans.
Being here.
Yes, and we'll be back with another podcast next week. So we will talk to you then. All right, bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.